The Winnipeg Lab story seems to have it all, doesn't it? It has international intrigue, it has biodiversity, it has bioweapons, it has political intrigue, court challenges, everything on the go. We're just starting to find out about it, and we still don't know enough. Hello, my name's Brian Lilly. This is the Full Comment Podcast, and this week, we're going to delve into the Winnipeg Lab story. We were told that we couldn't find out why two scientists were suddenly fired from their positions there after years of service because of national security concerns. Recently, hundreds of pages of evidence were released to the House of Commons and to the general public as a result. What did we find out about that, and what are the political implications? We're joined by two great guests today. Phil Gursky is a retired CSIS officer who spent many years in the service, and Michael Chong, conservative MP, foreign affairs critic, and someone who has been at the forefront of fighting to get these documents released. Gentlemen, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Brian.
Great to be here.
Let me start with you, Phil, on the security and intelligence side. Now that we've seen the documents, was there anything in there that jumped out at you and said these should never have been released due to security issues, national security concerns?
It's a great question, Brian. And those of us who worked in national security, we are pledged to protect two major aspects of what we do. That is sources and methods. So, for example, if you've got a unique human source that's infiltrated, let's say, a terrorist cell, the last thing you want is for that person's name to be released because that person ends up dead. Okay, so you got to be very careful with that. In terms of methods, you may have a way to crack a code, for example, or access someone's communications that are trying to be hidden. And you don't want the bad guys to find that out either. So without going into the details as to the documentation that was released finally to those who wanted to see it, my position as a former CSIS analyst, and I also spent 17 and a half years at CSC, so even more sensitive signals intelligence, is that yes, the Canadian public has a right to know, especially when governments are ignoring a problem such as Chinese interference and theft of our biotechnology. And yes, there were concerns about protecting sources and methods. And as a retiree, maybe I have a bit of a biased opinion, but I err more on the side of releasing more than releasing less. Insofar, and provided that nothing really, really sensitive makes it into the public domain, I think Canadians should learn more about this because we clearly have a government that wants to keep from us this very embarrassing story. It's really damaged our reputation with our allies as to why we let two Chinese scientists linked to the Chinese Communist Party, to the People's Liberation Army, working in a level 4 lab with the most dangerous materials known on the planet, why the government failed to prevent them from doing so. Obviously, it's a very embarrassing story for them. And I think what we're learning just simply points out something I've been saying for a long time now, that this government had the intelligence in advance about these people and didn't abide by it. And that's a huge problem.
By they didn't abide by it, do you think that they didn't act soon enough to remove the two scientists? And we're talking about Zheng Guoqi and her husband, Keting Chen. He was a bit lower on the scale than she was, but she was one of the top scientists there. They were both working in the lab with some of the most sensitive material. You think they should have gone in and relieved them of their duties sooner?
It's hard to say if they acted too late, Brian, or didn't act at all. So we saw with the leaks of the CSIS information on the interference by the People's Republic of China in our 2019 and 2021 elections, they didn't even read the intelligence to begin with. We saw the public safety minister say, no, I didn't bother reading my inbox to see what CSIS told me. So it's not so much a matter of reading it, you know, it's not important, or there are other considerations at play here. This could very well be a case of, we didn't bother, you know, acknowledging what CSIS told us in the first place, which is endemic in Canada. And another term I use an awful lot is that we have a very poor intelligence culture here. And by that, I don't mean CSIS and CSC and the RCMP. I mean officials that don't understand the nature of intelligence, don't see the value of it, and fail to act on it. So it could be a matter of not acting soon enough. It could be a matter of not bothering to read the intelligence in the first place.
Michael, when you and your party were raising questions on this going back 2-3 years, I remember the Prime Minister leaning into this issue and warning the conservatives that they didn't want to get into anti-Asian racism by pushing this story.
That's exactly right, Brian. When we first raised this issue 3 years ago and we asked for these documents, the first thing the government did, including the prime minister, was to accuse us of anti-racism, anti-Asian racism, of Sinophobia, and of, playing partisan games, which was completely ridiculous. And when that tact didn't work, he then switched to another tact. He hid behind ENCICOP and said, we'll give the documents to ENCICOP, which is the government's committee made up of parliamentarians, but not a parliamentary committee. And that committee can't release these kinds of documents, doesn't have the authority to release these kinds of documents. So then
that committee can only report to the prime minister, correct?
That's right. It's a prime minister's committee. The members on the committee serve at the pleasure of the prime minister. So they're not only GIC appointments, in other words, governor and council appointments, they're at pleasure governor and council appointments. The prime minister can dismiss a member at any moment in time. The prime minister appoints the chair of the committee. The prime minister has the right to redact the committee's reports and to demand that the committee rewrite certain sections of reports. So it's essentially a committee under the PMO's control. And so it's not the appropriate place to hold the government accountable. When that tact didn't work, they came up with a bunch of other excuses about why we couldn't get the documents. They then punted it to an ad hoc committee that sits outside Parliament. We reluctantly agreed to it. Because after the election, the NDP wouldn't cooperate with the Bloc Québécois and the Conservatives to demand the documents once again. And so we were left with this last option. And I think what over the last 3 years has been made 100% clear is that we should have gotten these documents 3 years ago. You know, a panel of four MPs and three judges said that the public has a right to know these documents, that national security was not a legitimate excuse to prevent the release of these documents, and that all the government was doing was trying to hide itself from an embarrassing an embarrassing oversight over our national security. So, I finished by saying this, Brian, when in Ottawa and in Canada generally, governments are not transparent enough compared to other democracies like the United States, like the UK, like many European democracies. They're just not transparent enough. They don't give us the information that Parliament and the public deserves. And they often do it through three excuses. Number one, they say it's a national security reason why they can't release documents. Two, they say it's because of privacy concerns. Or three, they just don't give the resources, put the resources in place so that access to information is done in a more timely manner. So whenever you hear, privacy or national security, red flags should go up that the government's just trying to cover its rear end rather than protect national security or privacy.
But just today, we're recording a couple of days before this is released. They've let it be known that they ordered a national security review of TikTok last September, but they're not going to release it. The United States is in the middle of Congress passing a bill to ban TikTok through the House of Representatives, and they're putting all kinds of evidence on the table as to why. And our government says, well, we ordered a national security review, but we can't release it because of the Investment Canada Act. So that's not even national security. We found another reason to keep stuff secret, Michael. But before we delve into some of the details, let me ask you, you just kind of glossed over how much the government fought this. And as a longtime observer of Parliament, both federally and in several provinces, having covered Quebec and Ontario extensively and some other provinces to a lesser degree, I've never seen a government fight the release of documents so hard. They ignored votes by parliamentary committees calling for the documents, which under our system, the documents should have been released at that point. They ignored a vote of the full House of Commons for the documents to be released. The clerk of the Privy Council was called to the bar and censured, and they refused to release them. And then they took the Speaker of the House of Commons to court. Have you ever seen anything so fulsome in its attempt to block the release of information?
I haven't, Brian. And what's even more ironic and egregious about all of that is that these were four orders of the House and its committee, two orders of the Canada-China Committee, and two orders of the House of Commons as a whole for these documents. The House ordered the government to hand over these documents. And what's so ironic about all this is that when the House and its committee made these four orders for the production of these documents, the government thumbed its nose at those orders and completely ignored them. At the same time, the same minister responsible for the Winnipeg Labs and the Public Health Agency of Canada, Minister Patty Hajdu, was issuing orders of her own, along with her cabinet colleagues, for public health compliance around the pandemic and encouraging Canadians and ordering Canadians to abide by public health rules. All the meanwhile, they were thumbing their nose at four orders of the most senior body in the land, the Parliament of Canada. So, you know, the ironies abound here. The government clearly was trying to cover itself from political embarrassment. And they, as you said, they went to great lengths in an unprecedented action. They took the Speaker of the House of Commons to court. And then they also triggered an early election in August of 2021. And the reason why that's so significant is that under parliamentary rules, these four orders of the House and its committee dissolved with the dissolution of Parliament and the calling of a general election. So it was a convenient way to make the problem go away. And so, yes, they went to unprecedented steps to try to bury all of this. And here we are 3 years later, and we finally got the documents.
Brian, can I just pick up on something that Michael just said about irony?
Sure.
I find it highly ironic that a government which ignores national security, which ignores intelligence that our agencies produce to try to protect Canada from nefarious actors, cites national security as a reason not to release documents. I mean, you can't say one thing on a Monday and say the exact opposite on a Tuesday. Here's a government.
Oh, I've been around politics a while.
Maybe I'm being a little naive here, but it just seems to me that, I mean, this government is one of the most egregious. And I've worked, we're going back to the first Trudeau days when I started my career. So I've been around a long time. This government has been the most egregious in ignoring intelligence, and for it to cite national security as a reason is laughable. Secondly, I'm getting really sick and tired of this anti-racism thing that's being leveraged against our security services and law enforcement, saying, you know, CSIS is being anti-Chinese racist by suggesting the mere possibility that China's spying on us and stealing our secrets. For God's sakes, we've been saying this for 25 years. And we've been accused of being racist for doing so. And those of us who work in this business, whether we're law enforcement officers or security intelligence officers, we're really growing tired of a bunch of people who've never worked in the business pointing fingers at us and calling us racist. So just please stop and listen to our intelligence at the same time.
Before going back into the media, I remember working for a municipal government out in the West End of Ottawa, and there was a large Nortel facility next to us. And we've all heard the stories of Nortel basically being pillaged by Huawei to steal all the secrets and collapse the company. More than once, people were escorted out of Nortel by police for stealing security secrets or stealing industrial. So it's both government secrets, it's industrial secrets, and we've known it's been going on for a while. But, you know, when we look at this Winnipeg lab story, we know that Dr. Cui was, it was 2018 when PIAC was first advised that she was listed as an inventor on a Chinese patent that contained scientific information produced by the Canadian lab in Winnipeg. That is not something that she was allowed to do under her terms of employment, and she did it without permission, and it was for an inhibitor for the Ebola virus. She's not fired until sometime in 2019. It's months, almost a year later before that happens. What jumped out to you, Phil, from the security side, the moving of information, the moving of actual virus samples? I mean, these all seem to be egregious violations that we shouldn't be happy with, but they seem to go on for months and months before doing anything.
One thing that those of us in security intelligence, Brian, have often been accused of is holding our cards too close to our chest. not informing people in due time, not providing enough information. A lot of complaints, people say, well, you showed me the intelligence, but you didn't show it all, you know, all the intelligence to me. You know, you can always do things better. I know I worked in signals intelligence. I worked in human intelligence. There's always better ways of communicating what you know to your clients, to your customers, senior government officials. That's not the case here. CSIS would have provided this information in a timely fashion to the people at PHAC who needed to know it. The reasons why they chose to sit on it, ignore it, not bother reading it, not act upon it, I really have no idea. This is not CSIS's fault here. Now, I didn't work China at CSIS. I was a counterterrorism guy, but I knew lots of people that did. And I know for a fact that our investigation into Chinese activities on our soil, counter to sections 2A and 2B of the CSIS Act, so foreign espionage and foreign interference, have been very robust since the service was created back in 1984 out of the old RSMP Security Service. CSIS is doing its job. It's providing the intelligence, and they're probably getting foreign intelligence from CSE as well in terms of signals. This stuff is being given to the people that need to get it, Brian, and it's being given to them in a way that they can actually act upon it. So the question isn't, you know, why didn't CSIS do its job better? The question is, why didn't the clients take this seriously and act upon it in a quicker way so that this scientist didn't have access to more information over the months that she did before she was finally fired? They're the ones that have to answer your question, not CSIS.
Yeah. So from September 2018 until July 5th, 2019 is when they're informed that there's an investigation into them. They should stay home pending the results of the investigation. I agree with you. You know, I've heard the complaints that you know, intelligence services can hold their cards too close to their chest. But this is a government, we saw this with over several files, especially going into areas like public safety, whether it was the Bernardo transfer, the Freedom Convoy, and what messages people read and didn't read about what was going to happen, what intelligence they read and didn't read. It seems like information comes in and nobody bothers to read it. Before I go to you, Michael, Phil, that's got to be demoralizing for the intelligence service.
Oh, I can tell you that in spades, Brian. I don't work, you know, I retired 9 years ago from CSIS, but I still stay in contact with a lot of my former colleagues, and the morale is in the toilet for that very reason. So, you know, you remember the famous leaks from a year and a half ago to the Globe Mail about the interference in the elections. Now, I have no idea who released the information. The assumption is it was CSIS, not necessarily. It could have been a client who released the information. We don't know. We don't have the answer to that yet. But if it were a CSIS employee, I do not support it because I don't support the release of secret intelligence into the media, but I certainly understand the frustration. So imagine that you go to work every day with one thing and one thing in mind only, to do the best job you can to collect intelligence and information, make sure it's true, so you confirm your sources, you know, are they reliable or not, and you inform the government of what you know to keep Canada safe and to, you know, help us prosper. And you realize when you go home at night that no one gives a rat's posterior about what you've just told them, because it's inconvenient, it's going to interfere with our economic relations, it's going to make people feel bad, you know, the old Canadian thing, I'm sorry if I'm offending you kind of thing. What do you think that does to morale? What do you think it does to people who are really putting, you know, their honest effort, recruiting sources, running investigations, getting court warrants to intercept communications, doing, you know, physical surveillance to provide the best story possible so that we understand what people are doing here, that it's against our interests, and you realize that nobody is paying any attention to it. Yeah, it's having a huge impact on morale, and I feel sorry for my former colleagues as a consequence.
Michael, your thoughts on how and why the government didn't act sooner, you know, beyond hiding everything. They seem to have known for a long time that they should be asking questions or putting in guards to keep, especially more key than Chang, but both of them from being able to share information, send information. I mean, at one point in the documents, we find out that they brought in people from the People's Liberation Army of China, from one of their universities that deals with bioweapons.
Yeah.
And gave them full access to everything.
Yeah. So two questions pop up for me in this whole saga about how the lab was not being protected by, you know, the management within the government of Canada. The first is, why did it take so long to detect the clandestine and corrupt and covert behavior of Dr. Q, as you call her, Dr. Chu, some people pronounce it differently, and Dr. Chang, right? Why did it take 2 years for that to be discovered? As you pointed out, Brian, the first red flag goes up, at least the first red flag we read in the documents that we finally got. First red flag goes up in September 2018. That red flag is a departmental security officer within the Public Health Agency of Canada discovering that Dr. Chu, the head of the lab, had registered a patent in China, which is a big no-no, which is in contravention of government policy. All intellectual property produced by government scientists are to be registered in Canada because Canadian taxpayers have paid for it. And so government rules are clear. She registered a patent in China. This first gets detected in September 2018. So the first question is, prior to that, for 2 years, she had taken, in 2017 and 2018, she had gone to the People's Republic of China 5 times, often for 2 or more weeks at a time. And during those 5 trips, she did a number of things that were clandestine and covert and corrupt. She had her travel within China paid for by the People's Republic of China and by the People's Liberation Army. She met with entities and scientists there covertly without telling, without getting approval from her, from management in the government of Canada. And this happened in 2017, 2018, doesn't get detected for several years until 2019. So the first question is, why did it take so long for red flags to go up about this covert, clandestine, and corrupt behavior on part of this scientist? The second question that pops up for me is, once the red flag is raised on this by the departmental security officer about the registered patent in China in September 2018, why did it take 10 months to secure the Winnipeg lab? In fact, in the first 6 months of 2019, she had access to the lab. During those 6 month period, government IT employees seized the computer that she was using there and carted off. She also at the time applied for another trip to China and was denied approval for that additional trip. And so these two things happened in the first 6 months of 2019, yet she's not denied access to the lab. She's not marched out of the lab. The lab isn't secured until July 5th of 2019. So why did it take 10 months to secure the lab? It should have happened a lot earlier. If your employer is seizing your hard drive and your computer to analyze it, presumably, they should be locking you out of the premises as well at that point and not waiting for several more months to pass before doing that.
That's when you do the suspended with pay. Stay home while we look into this.
That's right. And that didn't happen, actually, till July 5th, 2019. So these are the questions that we hope to examine at a parliamentary committee whenever we can get the agreement of the Liberals and the NDP on this.
Has anybody been able to ask, or is it just now with the documents that you can get to these sort of questions? Have you been able to ask PHAC or Health Canada why they didn't act sooner?
No, we haven't, because I tried to have this studied at the Access to Information, Privacy and Ethics Committee about a week ago, but the New Democrats teamed up with the Liberals to shut that study down. So we're going to try to do this at the Canada-China Committee. We think that's another committee that would be appropriate to study this. And so hopefully we get the agreement of the NDP and the Liberals to conduct the study, to hear from witnesses. These documents are just a start. We need to ask some serious questions about what happened so that we can issue a report with recommendations to the government to hold it accountable. Like, for example, Minister Mark Holland has said, after these documents were released several weeks ago, that it wasn't him or his cabinet colleagues that denied us these documents 3 years ago. He blamed the civil servants in the Public Health Agency of Canada for overclassifying the documents and refusing to release them. So we are going to call these bureaucrats, these civil servants in front of committee to say, why did you deny us the documents 3 years ago? The minister said that you are responsible for releasing the documents. And clearly, three judges and four MPs said you overclassified them, you refused to release them inappropriately to cover up embarrassment rather than protect national security. So we want to get to the bottom of why that release of information isn't happening when Parliament demands it.
I did love the fact that the government that that took the Speaker to court, that ignored four orders of Parliament, suddenly decided to blame the bureaucrats. As a former longtime resident of Ottawa, let me tell you, this will not help them come election time. Civil servants remember when governments blame them and punish them accordingly.
Hey, Brian, you work in a difficult business where, you know, there's accountability and the bottom line is always front and center. Well, Minister Mark Holland has also said that no one in the Public Health Agency of Canada or in the Winnipeg Lab is going to be held accountable and terminated for these serious national security breaches. And I also find that appalling. Somebody needs to be held accountable here. We cannot have, you know, a government that commits this kind of egregious breach of our national security that allows People's Liberation Army scientists into the lab, allows materials and information, sensitive information, be transferred to the government and the military of the People's Republic of China, and not have somebody be held accountable for this. And if it's not going to be a civil servant that's held accountable, then the minister should do the honorable thing and be held accountable.
It gets worse, guys. The minister also said recently that we are not going to stop collaboration with the People's Republic of China in the level 4 lab. We'll just give them access to lower level files than the most dangerous stuff. And I'm thinking, wait now, you just had an egregious breach of very, very sensitive, dangerous technology. Wouldn't a prudent approach be, we're going to suspend all collaboration with the People's Republic of China until we get to the bottom of this to see if there aren't other scientists that are linked to the PLA or the CCP? And yet, no, being good Canadians, we don't want to, I guess, piss the Chinese off. So we're going to let them, wander around the lab a little bit more and see what else they can pick up.
Okay, hold those thoughts, gents, because I want to talk about that more. When we come back, we've got to take a quick break, and I want to talk about that, but also claims of a link to the Wuhan Institute of Virology and the study of bat coronaviruses. We'll talk about all of that when we come back. When the government was hiding a lot of information on the Winnipeg Lab documents and what happened, what really went down, it led to a lot of speculation. The government wanted to call them conspiracy theories, but in the absence of legitimate information, in the absence of them correcting the record, of course, people are going to wonder. One of the things many people wondered was, did the Winnipeg Lab and its association with the Wuhan Institute of Virology have anything to do with coronavirus, COVID-19, the lab leak theory? And of course, we have found out in the documents that Dr. Qi, or Dr. Chu, as Michael has correctly told me the name is pronounced, that she did work with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Does that raise alarm bells for either one of you gentlemen that she was working not only with the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but with Batwoman, the woman who's famous for going into the caves of Southeast Asia to look for bats and bat viruses?
I think for me that, you know, this whole story suggests is that when you deal with a government like the PRC, okay, I understand our economic relations with China are important. I understand there's jobs. A lot of our exports go to China, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what the trade balance is like between Canada and China. I'm guessing it's in their favor, but I'm not an economist. What it suggests to me is that you've got to be really, really careful with whatever institute or organization you deal with. They are not a liberal secular democracy like Canada is. They are not above board. They do not put things in the public domain like we do. And so as a consequence, whenever you try to enter into some relationship with a Chinese organization of whatever level, you should be naturally suspicious. And that doesn't mean you're anti-Asian or anti-Chinese. It's doing due diligence in that you're dealing with a government that is not an ally of ours, that is making threatening moves around the world and is taking advantage of, as you mentioned, BlackBerry, Brian, robbed us blind on BlackBerry and Nortel for years and years and years. To me, that's just a prudent way for government to act, not to say, hey, here's the kitchen, take what you want, and you can pay on the way out if you want or not, it doesn't really matter. And yet we don't seem to do that here in Canada.
I think Dr. Chu's collaboration with the Wuhan Institute of Virology is problematic in two areas. First, she covertly and clandestinely transferred information and materials to entities in the PRC, like the Institute of Virology, without the government of Canada's knowledge. I mean, that's the first problem. I think the second problem is that she helped create this lab in the People's Republic of China. The lab in Winnipeg is what's called a level 4 lab. It's the highest designation of a lab in the world. In Canada, we only have one. It's the Winnipeg National Biology, Microbiology Laboratory. It handles the world's, these level 4 labs handle the world's most dangerous pathogens and viruses, like Ebola, like coronaviruses, and the like. The PRC did not have a level 4 lab until Dr. Chu made several visits over there to help train up the scientists and establish that lab as a level 4 lab. And here's why that's a problem. The State Department, in its cables from its embassy in the U.S. State Department, in cables it received from its embassy, in U.S. embassy in Beijing, revealed that U.S. government employees went down to visit the lab just to, you know, as part of, you know, their due diligence in the scientific community to review the lab and to see whether or not it was abiding by the strict level 4 processes to prevent a global pandemic from emerging because of an escape of a virus. And what they found was alarming. They discovered that the lab had lax security procedures, lax rules around how to handle these viruses. And as a result, they wrote a cable back to the U.S. government saying, we are very concerned about the lax standards at this lab. It is a global health risk, the way this lab's being run. And the fact that the lab was established in part by the training that Dr. Chu from Winnipeg provided, you know, is a problem. And so, you know, I think these are the two worrisome things that connect Winnipeg to Wuhan. Now, I'll finish by saying this. U.S. intelligence has made an overall assessment that the likelihood that the pandemic emerged from the lab is low. They believe that the overwhelming balance of probability is that the virus from this pandemic emerged from the wild, somewhere in the People's Republic of China, but that it did not emerge from the lab. That said, you know, we can't discount the fact that, you know, this lab was handling dangerous viruses and pathogens. It was a security risk, and that the head of the Winnipeg lab had a big hand in establishing this Wuhan Institute of Virology as a level 4 lab. So, you know, I think that just says to me that, you know, we should be cutting off all collaboration between the Winnipeg lab and any entities in the PRC until we can be assured that none of this kind of stuff is ever going to happen again.
Before we get into the ongoing cooperation, let me just ask you about one other area that Dr. Chu collaborated in. We mentioned it earlier, but didn't really examine it. And that is this university affiliated with the People's Liberation Army and their lab that focuses on bioweapons. That is a complete red flag that should have had everything shut down as soon as CSIS or whichever intelligence agency alerted the government to it. I mean, it isn't working with a group that focuses on developing bioweapons something we should be really worried about one of our people doing, Phil?
100%. You know, I don't know. I'm very skeptical that we here in Canada are developing bioweapons. It would seem to be against the nature of being Canadian. But the fact that we're allowing a bunch of scientists to come in who are, you know, citizens of a country that we know to be developing these bioweapons, and we're handing our technology over to them scot-free so they can be used by their host countries to do this, is abominable. I just don't understand why you'd want to do that. As I said earlier, you know, for the minister to say that we're going to keep working with China irrespective of what these two scientists did at the level 4 lab strikes me as like what parallel universe are you living in where you think this is an okay thing? And yeah, the door should have been slammed a long time ago, as Michael said. As soon as CSIS made its concerns, and by the way, CSIS did state quite clearly that one of the scientists was being very evasive in her answers. In other words, she lied. I've been, you know, I've had my security clearance many years, and you get all these interviews and stuff, and they can tell when you're telling a lie and when you're not most of the times. For that to be dismissed and not taken seriously, to me, is, again, one more example of what else do you want your security services to do? They're telling you this person is a risk to national security and public safety. What more do you want us to tell you in order for you to take action on a file of this regard?
Yeah, I agree with that, Brian. Look, here are the facts. 7 government scientists at the Winnipeg Lab collaborated on research with scientists in the PRC, in the People's Republic of China, on some of the world's most dangerous viruses and pathogens. That's a fact. That research is publicly available, and it shows that that research took place between the Winnipeg Lab and these PRC scientists. 6 studies were co-authored, at least 6 studies were co-authored from 2016 to 2020 between the Winnipeg scientists and the ones in the PRC. Some of those studies were scientists in the PRC who were members of the People's Liberation Army. And as you pointed out in your earlier remarks, they were not only members of the People's Liberation Army, they were members of a unit of the People's Liberation Army called the Academy of Military Medical Sciences that has a mandate to develop defensive and offensive bioweapons. And so the fact that this collaboration took place without the government shutting down that collaboration is appalling. And now the fact that the government is refusing to shut it down, all of it down now, is even more appalling. It should be shut down entirely, any collaboration, in order to ensure that we've got the proper procedures in place, the proper security in place to ensure that this kind of stuff never happens again.
The argument from the government has been in the past, well, you know, as we saw in the pandemic, if a virus gets out, it becomes a global, worldwide problem. And so we have to work with these other organizations. We have to work with these other countries. And I can understand that to a degree. But when the other country is continually violating intelligence rules, regularly interfering in your country, regularly doing things like trying to develop offensive and defensive bioweapons, something that Canadians would abhor, that's when you should cut it off. Michael, is it, you know, from the political side, is this just being afraid of, as Phil put it, pissing off the Chinese? Is this afraid to stand up to Beijing, or are they just naive?
Brian, I think it's 2 things. I think they're naive in the extreme, the government, the Liberal government, the Trudeau government. But I also think there's an element of, you know, this kind of dogma that basic discovery-led scientific research should have no restrictions on it, none whatsoever. And that, you know, this basic discovery-led research should trump national security, should trump Canada's defense and security interests. And I completely disagree with that. At the end of the day, the government of Canada has the right to say that our national security supersedes the funding of basic research at our universities and at government laboratories. And because we have a primary responsibility as a government to protect the safety and security of Canadians. And no, you can't collaborate with the People's Liberation Army. You can't collaborate with the Academy of Military Medical Sciences, I should say, in the People's Republic of China, because they are doing gain-of-function research to weaponize civilian research, to take this basic university and government research and to turn it into military bioweapons. And so, no, you don't have the academic freedom to collaborate in that way, and we're going to shut that down. And I think that is a responsibility the government of Canada needs to take, and they need to get off this kind of weird ideology they have that basic science trumps defense and security. It doesn't. Our defense and security is the most important thing that the federal government has to do to protect the safety and security of Canadians.
When you work in intelligence, you deal with a lot of different actors, a lot of different countries. And so sometimes you're forced to, because of the nature of the threat, to deal with countries that, let's just say, don't share the same values that you do. And I'll go back to the post 9/11 period in counterterrorism where I worked. We were talking to some countries that normally you wouldn't, but you really had no choice because the threat was what it was. But there's a reason why, and you've probably all heard of the term the Five Eyes, the Anglo partners, which is sort of the bedrock of intelligence here in Canada. It's been around since the Second World War. there's a reason why you share more with the Five Eyes, and I would extend that based on my time at CSIS to a lot of Western European partners as well that are not part of the Five Eyes, because we all share the same basic values and ethics. China is not part of the Five Eyes. China is not part of the Western world. And so for us, as Michael said, to say, well, you know, academic freedom is more important than national security, like hell it is. And, you know, we don't have to work with China on these bio issues. We have other partners with which we can work, like the Americans, like the Brits, like the other Western European partners. And to me, that's a safer bet. Now, look, there's no guarantees in intelligence that information that you share, once it leaves, you know, leaves your borders, it can be compromised. That's just the nature of the business. But you go home at night a little more confident if you shared with the Americans, the Brits, and I don't know, the Swedes, than if you shared with the Russians or the Chinese. Let's just put it that way. And the fact that the government doesn't seem to get this is a very, very worrisome development as far as I'm concerned.
I can't remember if it was on the Winnipeg Lab side of things or on the election interference. But at one point, as one of the stories came out, Jerry Butts, the, you know, long ago former principal secretary to Prime Minister Trudeau, said, when Bob Fyfe and Steve Chase, the Globe and Mail, see someone having dim sum, they now think it's foreign interference. And I thought, wow, that really does show the mentality that they want to diminish everything to not offending China. But no, it's the People's Republic of China. It's the dictators in Beijing. It's the People's Liberation Army. There is this, and I still think it is naivete on China with this government. We know the Trudeau family has been infatuated with the PRC going back to the 1950s, with all of them visiting even outside of politics and fascinated with how they operate. And so they just don't seem to want to put any guardrails or any controls over any of this. And Phil, I really do think that that opens us up to very worrisome national security threats.
It does. And As I said earlier, a lot of us are getting sick and tired of saying that if CSIS has an investigation based on reasonable grounds of suspect, which is what the CSIS Act says about Chinese activities, to be immediately labeled by the government as being anti-Asian racist, we're really getting tired of that. And you talk about national security, Brian. The other thing that needs to be mentioned here is that our closest allies are looking at us very, very carefully right now. And they're asking themselves, if Canada can't protect very serious level 4 lab bio information that should not find its hands into the way of the PLA and the CCP, what are they going to do with our information? Can we trust Canada to protect our most sensitive intelligence? Those conversations are being had, by the way. I've got my sources telling me that you know, people are really wondering if Canada is a reliable partner when it comes to national security and intelligence.
We've already seen ourselves kept out of the Three Eyes on two different
occasions.
Michael, I've spoken to many politicians who've gone to the PRC on visits, and I don't know if you have, but the security warnings are extensive. The use of burner phones, not taking your usual laptop, not accepting any thumb drives back when those were a big thing still, and not accepting anything that could compromise. I mean, we know that China is constantly trying to gain information, trying to interfere, trying to exert influence. So why on this file or on the election file is this government unwilling to act?
I have, Brian, gone to China. I was accompanied Prime Minister Harper on his official visits to the People's Republic of China. And so I, too, was made aware of all these security risks that were over there that could threaten us. Why the current government has been slow to react is, you know, again, I think you're right. It's a combination of naivete and other factors. I think it's, you know, this is a government that came to office very naive. You know, don't forget, this is a government that came to office promising to broaden and deepen ties, to reestablish diplomatic relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And then did a 180 on that because they realized that the Harper government was correct in cutting off diplomatic relations with the regime.
I remember speaking to Stéphane Dion in Scrums, and he said that your government had been ideological in not talking to Russia or the Islamic Republic of Iran.
That's right. And as the government came to office, naively wanting to broaden and deepen ties with China, when it was becoming clear in 2016 and 2017 that a new China had emerged under President Xi. And President Xi was a president who was going to not liberalize China and bring it closer into the rules-based democratic order that we have, that has assured the world's peace and security since the end of the Second World War. But rather, he was going to double down on autocracy, and he was going to double down on the crackdowns on the tech sector, again, you know, on minorities in China, on threatening neighbors in the South China Sea, and crackdowns in Hong Kong and so many other things. That was clear by 2017. We were starting to get evidence. Well, you'll remember the famous press conference with Minister Dion, where in Canada, a journalist asked his Chinese counterpart a question and got basically chewed out in front of Minister Dion. You saw at the same time around 2017 the detention of Western journalists, including journalists, Canadian journalists in the PRC. So by 2017, we know that a new China is emerging, an autocratic China that's going to throw its weight around and threaten Western interests and Western values. And at that time, the Prime Minister naively still believes that he's going to establish a free trade agreement with China, that he's going to broaden and deepen ties with China, and that all comes to naught. And it isn't till 2020 or 2021 that the government finally realizes that China's changed and that it's a threat to Canada. And it took them that long to get to that realization.
Our first vaccine for COVID was supposed to be developed with China. Now, that vaccine, I think it was used, the last I remember looking, I don't think it even really made it to market in China. It was used experimentally on the military, but that was our response to COVID, was to cooperate with people that we already knew were undermining and attacking us.
Well, and that CanSino vaccine, it actually it has a Winnipeg connection. Dr. Chu worked with CanSino and collaborated with CanSino. And so that's another thing we need to find out of the committee. Was the PRC's decision not to allow for the export of trial samples of the virus during the pandemic, was that retaliation for the government securing the Winnipeg lab and suspending Dr. Chu and Dr. Cheng from the lab? You know, so again, you know, another example of why we need to find out more about what happened.
My colleague Terry Glavin over at National Post has written that the way the Trudeau government's handled this is just another example of their attempts to cover up China's influence. And he ties this into China's foreign interference and influence writ large, be it industrial, interfering in the elections. As you sit back and you look, do either one of you have hope of anything good coming out of the foreign interference inquiry? Michael, I know I might be putting you in a spot there. You're going to be speaking to it, but we'll have the report, we'll have the hearings, and then what? You know, Phil, I think back to, you said you started under Pierre Trudeau. The Sidewinder report was the 1990s? No, 1980s?
Late
1990s. Nothing ever happened with that. Are we ever going to have a political culture in Ottawa that takes this stuff seriously?
My fear is the answer is no. And I will answer your question with a question, Brian. We've had these several kicks of the can over the use of the Emergencies Act against the so-called Freedom Convoy back in 2021. We have a government saying it's going to ignore the recommendations of the court and is going to, in fact, appeal against the federal court ruling that the Emergencies Act was invoked illegally, which in fact it was, because the Emergencies Act can only be invoked under a national security as determined by CSIS, and CSIS said there's no national emergency here. So they did it illegally. If we have a government that, you know, plans inquiries, I like to joke, Brian, that, you know, we have royal commissions in Canada twice a week because it's kind of part of our DNA. How many royal commissions and inquiries have actually resulted in recommendations that have A, been accepted, and B, have been followed up on and actually implemented. So no, this inquiry is a waste of taxpayers' money and time. It's unnecessary because if the government had listened to CSIS intelligence back in the, as far back as 2008, Brian, then Director Dick Fadden was called a racist by the Liberals and the NDPs because he raised the possibility that China was interfering in our affairs. So no, I have no confidence the inquiry will make any bit of difference. It's all for show. And I don't think the recommendations, if there are any, will be followed up on. And it's just one more, I think, example of a government that fails at an intelligence culture.
Michael, last word to you.
Sure. Well, I'm going to reserve judgment on the inquiry until Justice Hogue publishes a report. And that will allow me to make a determination of whether or not, you know, the inquiry has served a useful purpose. But to the broader point, we should never have needed a public inquiry, just like we should never have needed this ad hoc committee of 4 MPs and 3 judges to determine whether or not the Winnipeg lab documents should be released. What this all should have been done in a functioning parliament, where committees like the committees of the UK Parliament, like the committees of the US Congress, are able to hold the government accountable. So we should never have gotten to the point where we had to have a public inquiry to get to the bottom of this, of these foreign interference threats from China directed at our parliament, directed at our general elections. This accountability, these inquiries, this investigation should have taken place at a parliamentary committee.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I only called for a public inquiry in several columns because the government refused. PMO was obviously, in my view, interfering in the work of the committees. And I know that the members all say they're independent, but you know, you could see as soon as PMO decided, just like they did with SNC-Lavalin, that things were getting too hot, Liberal MPs would change their mind on admitting more witnesses or following up on questions, having more meetings. This is exactly what a functioning parliament should be doing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, to Phil's point, these inquiries take a lot of time and they cost millions of dollars. Well, that's what we have parliament for. This Winnipeg lab document committee that was created sat outside parliament, took a long time to come to determination. And here we are 3 years later and we finally got the documents. This stuff should be happening in parliament and its committees in a functioning parliament like we see in other democracies. And so, you know, we're left with the last resort, as you've pointed out, of having to agree to the ad hoc committee to release the documents, of having to agree to a public inquiry to get to the bottom of interference in our elections, because parliament isn't functioning the way it should. And that is on the government, because this is a government that came to office promising to strengthen parliament, to show respect for parliament, to provide parliament with information, and they've done anything but. In fact, just a week or two ago, the information commissioner announced she's taking the government to court to get documents released by the government. So it's a government that's completely reneged on its commitment to strengthen parliament and to show some respect for our democracy.
Openness and transparency, I believe, was their buzz phrase at the beginning, open by default. It hasn't worked out that way. Michael Chong, Phil Gursky, thank you both so very much for your time today.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think. Drop us a line. You can email me, blilly@postmedia.com. You can find me on social media. Drop a comment below if you're able to, wherever you're listening to or watching this podcast. Full Comment is a Postmedia podcast. My name is Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libben is the executive producer. You can subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, anywhere you get your podcast. Help us out by giving us a rating or leaving a review, and tell your friends about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.